we're going to jump back to resuscitation.
Over 400,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests that happen each year.
This is our most critically ill patient population.
There's some really important basics that we fundamentally have to accomplish.
It certainly highlights an enormous opportunity.
To me, that's incredible.
This is an alarming finding. Welcome everyone to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. So happy that you are joining us yet again for another outstanding podcast for an exciting topic. We're going to jump back to resuscitation. We talked about steroids and a number of critical illnesses in our last podcast. We're going to get back to a very critical component of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest resuscitation. But before doing so, let me bring in my co-host for this podcast, Dr. John Greenwood. It's Dr. Greenwood and myself for this podcast. Both Dr. Rodriguez and Dr. W have some important family commitments that they are attending to. And so we will circle back with all four of us during our next recording. But John, how are things going?
Well, thanks, Mike. Things are going great, I have to say. A lot of stuff has happened and is happening. As we were just kind of talking about before the podcast, really excited. We're just shipping out the fifth edition of the Emrepressordex. And for those who aren't familiar, this is a small, but I think really practical approach to vasopressors and inotropes and a lot of critical care medications that we often need to use in the ED and definitely in the ICU, but maybe aren't as familiar. So it's really problem-based based off of disease. It's been a great little reference text for the residents and as well as students. So for those who teach and educate, even who have APPs, who may be learning a little critical care, Dr. Winters and I, and a few others, Lillian Emlett and Haney Malamut, you may know, as well as a ton of really talented authors have put this together for a fifth edition. So that was published and released just about a week or two ago. And then also, not to be a human advertisement, but we have the resuscitation symposium coming up. So I have to say, Mike, I'm almost finished my lectures. I have one more to go, but I promise you it's not going to disappoint. I know the outline of the speakers looks incredible. I'm going to be talking about how to resuscitate the critically ill PE patient, some airway stuff, as well as sodium bicarbonate, which we've talked about a few times here. So got to bunch of really interesting talks. So looking forward to all of that.
As are we. Looking forward to learning from you, John. So congrats on Pressordex. I'm holding it as we record this podcast here. It is an awesome, awesome critical care medications guide that I carry with me into the ED with every shift. It is always in my bag, and it's a wonderful reference for those of you that aren't familiar with it. Really, really ideal for just-in-time information when you need it at the bedside. Congrats also, John didn't mention he had an article accepted in critical care medicine. So outstanding educational work, scholarly activity by our own Dr. Greenwood. And as he mentioned, we are looking forward to gathering in Austin, Texas for AAEM Scientific Assembly, whereby we will be within the resuscitation for the emergency physician add-on course, no longer calling it a pre-conference, but an add-on course. And so I'm excited to see all of you, John, included in Austin, Texas in just a few weeks. So with that, let's turn to the educational topic at hand. And as I alluded to, it is an important and a critical topic within out-of-hospital cardiac arrest resuscitation. This is our most critically ill patient population coming in. And this is really applicable not only to the ED, but this was carried out in the pre-hospital setting. So all of you that are pre-hospital providers, this is extremely pertinent to, along with the ED resuscitations. And John, I think we can even make some assumptions really about in-hospital cardiac arrest and this particular component, which is ventilation. More specifically, bag valve mask ventilation in cardiac arrest resuscitation. The article that we want to review here was just published within the last few months. It's published in Circulation. Lead author is Idris, and it is titled Bag Valve Mask Ventilation and Survival from Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, a Multi-Center Study. John, I've been talking already for a few minutes. I'm throwing it over to you. Give us the background as we lead into this particular study and discussion.
Absolutely. So I think all of us are well aware that there are a ton, over 400,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests that happen each year. And many of us are touched by these, as in the pre-hospital or in-hospital setting. But certainly, while we talk about fancy things like ECMO and all this other stuff, there's some really important basics that we fundamentally have to accomplish in order to improve outcomes. So I think there's a lot of research out there on chest compression metrics. Metrics for ventilation, though, really haven't been well studied. Ben Abella, who I work with, did a lot of work on chest compression metrics and outcomes in cardiac arrest. But I agree, I'm not really aware of much in the ventilation side of this. So it's uncertain whether the quality of ventilation or specific metrics affect patient outcomes. CPR alone really doesn't generate sufficient tidal volumes when we talk about gas exchange, including oxygenation and reduction in CO2. Now, professional responders usually give some form of ventilation in CPR, but it usually comes as a bag valve mask. We've moved away from routine endotracheal intubation immediately upon taking care of a patient with cardiac arrest. Oftentimes, it starts with a non-rebreather, and then we move to bag valve mask and maybe get to an LMA. Now, tidal volume is associated with detectable chest rise, and that's estimated to be somewhere around 300 to 500 mLs in terms of gas. Thoracic bioimpedance recordants have been shown and validated to measure ventilation frequency during CPR, which is kind of cool. It's like you detect the electricity running across the chest and you can kind of figure out whether or not ventilation is happening. So thoracic bioimpedance can be captured through defibrillator pads, interestingly enough. And during 30 to 2, so 30 chest compressions to 2 breaths CPR, one can assess ventilation using this bioimpedance signal, which is kind of cool. So the authors, Dr. Idris and colleagues, really wanted to determine if the incidence of bioimpedance-detected ventilation waveforms during bag valve mask ventilation in 30 to 2 CPR and assess the association of detectable ventilation with outcomes in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. So they really wanted to figure out, this is the question, can we detect adequate ventilation? And does this affect outcomes in cardiac arrest?
Thanks so much, John. This is really an important study because it's looking at our ventilation during out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And as you alluded to already, not much has been done in using this particular thoracic bioimpedance technology. So, what were the methods of this particular study? This actually was a secondary analysis of several sites that participated in a fairly big trial with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. This was the ROCK CCC trial. And for many of you, you know the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium. They did a trial a few years ago on continuous chest compressions versus standard CPR in patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. So what these investigators did is did a secondary analysis from several of those sites, and they really only focused in on those that were randomized in the 30 to 2 arm of CPR. Why is that? Well, they needed some time to be able to assess ventilation. So once again, the analysis was limited to those patients only in the 30 to 2 arm. So they included adults, non-traumatic cardiac arrest in the out-of-hospital setting, and those who actually had defibrillator recordings, whereby there was at least 2 minutes of 30 to 2 CPR provided by emergency medicine providers. They did not include those randomized to receive the continuous chest compressions in that particular study. And they also didn't include those whereby they looked at the tracing and couldn't really determine if they've got 30 to 2 or not, or they were only using three specific defibrillator machines that were able to detect that thoracic or had the thoracic bioimpedance technology within them. What did they do? In essence, looking at prior studies, and John, you alluded to this in the introduction there, in general, detectable ventilation yields about 300 to 500 mLs. And so what they determined in this study, utilizing thoracic bioimpedance, if there was a detection in ventilation, they thought the reasonable minimum threshold was about 250 cc's. And when we look at other studies, it's at least 250 mLs from a tidal volume that's needed to overcome anatomic along with physiologic dead space and produce meaningful gas exchange. So that was their threshold for detectable ventilations. Once again, 250 mLs. What was the primary outcome they were looking at? And in these patients randomized to 30 to 2 CPR, it was survival to hospital discharge. with secondary outcomes of ROSC really at any time. So within the pre-hospital setting, on arrival to the emergency department, what was the survival to hospital admission? And as we've talked about many times on the podcast, John, one of those important secondary outcomes, not a primary, but a secondary outcome of survival with favorable neurologic outcome as defined by these investigators as a modified Rankin score less than or equal to 3. So that's the nuts and bolts. That's the basics. John, I'm turning it back to you. Were there any important findings?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, this was a pretty large trial for cardiac arrest trials, and they included almost 2,000 patients, so 1,976 patients in this study. The mean age was fairly typical for what we see in most cardiac arrest research. The median age was 65 years old. It was two-thirds male predominance, and a total of over 26,000 compression pauses occurred in these nearly 2,000 patients. So this is a lot of data to go through, but there were some important findings. So when the authors looked at detectable lung inflation waveforms, so how often did detectable lung inflation happen? Well, in 60% of patients, less than 50% of pauses included detectable lung waveforms. So to me, that's incredible. Less than 50% of the time, there was a detectable lung waveform in 60% of patients. And that's contrasted with the other 40%, which did in fact have lung ventilation, effective ventilation, in greater than 50% of the pauses. So these patients were more often in a public location, witnessed, had bystander CPR, and initial shockable rhythm. So the primary outcome, the question was, did these patients survive to hospital discharge? So in the group that had less than 50% of the time during pauses had detectable lung waveforms or detectable ventilation, only about 4% of those patients survived to hospital discharge. So in those patients that did in fact receive, more commonly receive adequate ventilation, that survival to hospital discharge jumped to 13.5%. That's a pretty impressive gap. Now, as far as the secondary outcomes, so return of spontaneous circulation on ED arrival in that unventilated group, we'll call it, was only 18.7% compared to the increased or higher ventilation group was 30.7%. So they made it to the hospital. They made it to the emergency department with ROSC. Now, what about the important one, the survival to favorable neurologic outcome? Was there a difference in patients who less than 50% of CPR pauses received adequate ventilation? Well, in those that did, there was a 10.6% survival with favorable neurologic outcome compared to only 2.4% to those that did not receive adequate ventilation more than 50% of the time. So this was fairly impressive, Mike, and something that I was fairly shocked to see at first. I don't know about you.
Agreed. You threw out some important numbers and findings that I equally was shocked to see that in this large database, this large secondary analysis, that really 60% of people weren't getting adequate ventilations more than half the time, not even 250 mLs of detectable ventilation. And that, to me, that then portrayed out to survival differences along with differences in survival with favorable neurologic outcomes. So it certainly highlights an enormous opportunity to improve our BVM ventilation skills. It is what it's ringing true to me is that this is an alarming finding that we can certainly take. While it was looked at in the pre-out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, to me, you know, I think this really behooves us to take a look at how effective our BVM ventilation is across the spectrum from pre-hospital to ED, even to inpatient care.
Now, taking a step back, this was not a prospective analysis research study, right? So there certainly were some limitations. So in your opinion, what were the limitations here of this paper?
Great question, John. And every time we review a study, we highlight these and need to take these into account. I mentioned up in the methods section, they utilized devices that were really primarily from two manufacturers. And that's because Many other brands simply didn't have this bioimpedance technology or tracing, or they were simply of too poor quality to analyze. It did not include patients randomized to that continuous chest compressions, and assumingly they were getting asynchronous ventilation during those continuous chest compressions. Once again, and you hit a key limitation, is that this wasn't a prospective RCT. This was a secondary analysis of a clinical trial whose ultimate primary outcome was not the question or the primary outcome of this particular study. In addition, we don't really know that much about the characteristics of the patient. So perhaps patients that were in arrest and had a higher BMI, maybe they were getting adequate ventilation and just wasn't detectable by that thoracic bioimpedance. So a few things to consider as limitations of this particular study in circulation. But John, what would be some of your take-home points? What could we now take from this study, take back to the bedside for changes to our clinical care or further study?
Yeah, absolutely. I think really my take home from this is, as you were kind of talking about, we need to get back to the basics first and focus on the things that probably matter most, which is airway and breathing with circulation, right? Making sure that we're performing adequate ventilation, that we're have the patient in a good position to receive ventilation, getting a good chin lift, making sure that if we need to, two-hand bag valve mask ventilation while people are doing compressions, while someone else is squeezing the bag, making sure that we're able to provide adequate ventilation is so important, particularly to prevent hypoxic brain injury. And really, the ultimate goal is to RASC with neurologic recovery. And in this study, only 40% of the patients received detectable lung inflation in more than half of the paused CPR. So, as you said, that's a huge opportunity. Shout out to any of the device companies out there. If you want to put some money into something, maybe figure out how we can improve patient anatomy and open up that airway to achieve adequate ventilation during CPR. The study suggested overall poor oxygenation and ventilation during out-of-hospital cardiac arrest using resuscitation, using the simple basic tool that every EMS provider and clinician is provided with and after the first 5 minutes of arrest, which is a bag valve mask. And then detectable ventilations, even as small as 250 mLs and more than 50% of compression pauses was associated with increased RASC rates, an increased survival to discharge, an increased survival to favorable neurologic outcome. All of those things that we strive to achieve happen right up front within the first few minutes, within the first 15 minutes of care after cardiac arrest. So these are the things I took away and certainly the things that I will continue to teach, whether or not it's at the bedside in the hospital or outside, and advocate for, because I think it's focusing on the basics while ECMO and all that stuff is fun. We have to do a better job early on.
I think that's an outstanding way to conclude this discussion on this particular paper, John. Thanks so much. It's a shorter podcast, but very much enjoyed the conversation and going through this paper, really published at the end of 2023. And as you said, it really highlights a significant opportunity for the basics in terms of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest resuscitation. Well, you've heard what we think. We'd love to hear what you think about this particular paper, some additional take-home points, your thoughts. Shoot us an email through the website. Love to continue the interaction and the conversation on this particular trial. And well, if you don't, that's completely okay because we will look forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.